I've been asked to record this, so that's in my pocket, so hopefully that'll work. Yes, I've had to say to a few people that I don't live at Bonnie Doon. I actually live at Bonnie Hills, which is just down the road from Dunbogan. So, true story. We've been there for a whole 6 weeks, so I'm not quite oriented just yet. I realise in a conversation about cancer that it's probably going to be very raw for some of you. And Martin's already shared that it's impacting his family at the moment. Given that I'm in a room full of people that I've never met before, I don't want to make any assumptions. And it might be that as we talk today, there's quite a bit of pain for you, that there are things that you're grappling with, that there are challenges that you're facing. And if so, and if you'd like some support with that, I'm more than happy just to sit down with you afterwards and have a bit of a conversation. I'd like to take you back 7 years and tell you some of the things I didn't know 7 years ago. 7 years ago, I didn't know that one in two Australian men will get cancer. Now, that's an extraordinary statistic, isn't it? One in two. If I got all the fellas in the room to number off, one, two, one, two, one, two, that's how significant it is. We're talking about half the male population in Australia. Some stage in their life. Females doing a little bit better, one in three. But when you put those stats together, you're talking about something that is of a scale that cannot and shouldn't be ignored. Each of us will face the challenge of cancer or something like cancer, either personally impacting us directly or else people close to us, whether it's a relative or a close friend. Come on in, guys. So it's a big thing that we're talking about. Another thing that I couldn't have told you, accurately at least, I would have had a guess at it, is what's the most dangerous cancer to get? And by that I mean, what cancer do more people die from in Australia than any other? You want to have a guess at that? Skin cancer, that's a pretty good guess, because a lot of people do get skin cancer, but it's not the biggest killer by any means. It is actually lung cancer. I would have guessed something like breast cancer or bowel cancer, but the reality with lung cancer is it kills more Australians than breast cancer, bowel cancer and prostate cancer put together, and yet we rarely hear about it. Another thing that I wouldn't have been able to tell you 7 years ago is that 20% of people who get lung cancer are never smokers. I just assumed that if you got lung cancer, you probably had been smoking, and so, of course, that gets taken a step further to say, well, therefore you deserve it, because everybody knows that you shouldn't smoke. Mind you, I've seen an ad from the 1950s where people were encouraged to smoke if they had asthma, because it would help them feel better. So we've got to be a little bit tolerant, don't we, as we go back and we've learned a few things over the years. I couldn't have told you what cancer was. In fact, cancer's really a big umbrella term for hundreds of different diseases, but the thing that connects so many of them together is that it's got to do with a genetic mutation. Not quite like the X-Men, but significant genetic change. And I couldn't have described to you the fact that, you know, we've got all of these molecules in our body that are constantly reproducing, and there's billions of code impregnated or whatever in those molecules, and that if that code is not transferred absolutely accurate, if there's one or two parts of that that are different from what they were, then you'll get a mutation. And those of you who are doctor-type people, scientists, medico-type people, can fix me up on all this later, but it's a bit like having a spell checker built into your body that normally corrects any differences in code, but when the spell checkers fail, that's when you get tumours developing, when cancer impacts people. And everybody has that happen, but not everybody has it happen to the extent where tumours will grow in their body, where cells will be effectively permanently changed so you end up with cancer. Let me tell you, there's so many things that I didn't know 7 years ago. But on the 2nd of December 2011, I was sitting in a coffee shop in Canberra, and I interrupted the people that I was talking to, one of whom happened to be a doctor, and said, I'm struggling to breathe properly. My left arm has been getting number for the last few minutes. My left leg is starting to feel very heavy. And when I think about it, over the last few days, I've had a pain in my back between my shoulder blades and a sharp pain in my chest. Now, my friend who was sitting with me assumed that I was having a heart attack. And so they drove me quickly to one of the hospitals in Canberra. And if you ever want to get seen in casualty quickly, just say, query heart attack. You might have stubbed your toe, but hey, query heart attack gets you in very, very quickly. And of course, they put me in there and come in and hooked me up to an ECG, but it wasn't my heart. They then took x-rays, nothing much showed up. They then put me in for a CT scan, and they found that there was a dark mass basically right around my left lung, and another even darker one, probably a bit bigger than a golf ball, right on the edge of the lung. And I remember hearing the words from the doctor, "We think you have a tumour." Now, at that point, my tear ducts started to work quite powerfully because I heard it as, you're going to die. I heard it as, you've got something that is terminal, a death sentence. Now, that wasn't a bad response in a way because of what I was to hear later. The mass that they could see on the CT was 3 litres of fluid around my left lung. That's why I was breathless. That's why I was starting to go numb. The darker one was a lung tumour on that lung, which had sadly broken up. It had erupted somewhat so that they were then able to identify cancer had moved into other parts of my body. A few days later, I saw the oncologist in hospital and I said, "Can you tell me what's going on?" He said, "Yeah, we can confirm that you've got lung cancer. We'll need to biopsy and..." Well, they already had biopsy. Send that off, get pathology results, find out exactly what we're dealing with. But he had a pretty good idea. I said, "Well," and this is a dumb question to ask, I said, "So what can you do?" He said, "Well, there's actually nothing that we can do." He said, "You've got stage 4 lung cancer." If you don't know anything about staging, stage 1 is it's probably fairly small. It's limited to one part of the body. It hasn't spread at all. And often, you'll cut it out or you'll zap it with radiation and it'll be gone and you'll never have to worry about it again. Stage 4 means it's actually begun to metastasize and it's found in other bodily organs, and they were able to identify that. So within a few days, I'd gone from feeling, you know, middle-aged and not terribly fit to being told by the oncologist that I probably had 10 to 13 months left to live, and that there was no treatment that would remove my cancer. Now, I'm here 6.5 years later, so statistics are only ever that. They're predictors based on a summary of data from the past. They don't tell you anything necessarily about what's going to happen in the future. But I was one of the 1% to 5% of cancer patients who would expect to live for 5 years, 1% to 5%. And statistically, 10 to 13 months was where I was placed given my stage of cancer. Now, that's a big deal when you're 48 years of age, 49. That's a big deal when you've got 4 kids and 2 of them are still in high school. It's a big deal when you've actually, well, I was in the process of moving house, moving cities, moving states. We lived in Canberra. We had shipped all of our belongings to the north of Australia, to Darwin, where we'd bought a house. My wife had a job. I had a job to go to. The kids were enrolled in school. Everything was set to go. And we're in our last days literally saying goodbye. I was told that I now had a terminal disease. Now, I want to share with you something of the impact of that and dig into this topic of hope. Because I was going through an incredibly hope-destroying experience, really. And I want to give you 4 things, four, and they're going to start with F, right? So the first is physical. I thought being UTS, you might not know, but yeah, anyway.
We won't invite him back.
Okay. Physical, I want to talk about family, feelings and faith, all right? The rest okay? All right. I had to try and work out some way of memorising it. So physical, the physical impact on me was extraordinary. I actually went into hospital feeling that I wasn't too bad, I wasn't too unfit. I was actually looking forward to moving north and getting fit. I went in at 92 kilos and I came out 3.5 weeks later weighing 77. Now, what happened in hospital was my body went into shutdown. I had an operation and I've got three nice scars down here which I once told people were the result of a bikey fight. And my son told me, by the way, when I got out of hospital, "Dad, it's just as well you're already married because no one would marry you looking the way you do." Right? So body image is a big deal for people going through this kind of impact. But the operation did not work. It made me very, very sick. And my wife, who's a GP, told two of our closest friends that she didn't think that I would come out of hospital. I just crashed. You know, you have that thing in hospitals where they press a button, the code red button. Twice that happened for me. Where they really didn't think that I was going to make it. That is an extraordinary thing. Being given all of these painkillers to cope with having been opened up three times absolutely smashed me, wrecked everything else in my body from working properly, and it led to hallucinations that were terrifying that I couldn't distinguish from reality, that would take place whether my eyes were open or shut, night or day. We had people coming in to see me who I'm sure thought they were coming to pay their last respects. We had people who didn't come and see me because they were terrified of what they were going to see. We had a lawyer friend come in and I don't know, this is one of the, it's a hard thing to do because it really, it determines whether you trust your wife or not, okay? I signed over power of attorney to my wife to make decisions about whether I would be treated under certain conditions, what would happen to all of my finances. It's incredibly disempowering. We drew up wills because we realised that with four children we didn't have a current will. I got a tax accountant to come in because in our marriage I tended to handle the kind of internet banking and the tax and all of that, and Fiona never had anything to do with it. And so I was trying to set up things for her because I didn't think I'd be around. I've three boys and one girl, and I don't think I've ever had a harder conversation than sitting with my 15-year-old girl at the bedside in hospital, encouraging her and talking to her about what life without a dad might be like. Everything was falling apart around me. The physical impact on me, I did eventually get out of hospital on Christmas Eve. And I remember sobbing and weeping in the backyard as I listened to the neighbours laughing and playing games and thinking, I'm never going to be able to do those things. I was so weak that I could barely lift myself out of bed. They had to put a hospital bed into our home, and it took me months before I could even walk around the block. I needed to regain enough physical shape to be able to start on chemotherapy. The chemo was not expected to cure me from the cancer, but it was intended to alleviate symptoms and give me a better quality of life. But I don't think chemo and quality of life go together very well in the same sentence. One doctor described it as, we're going to work out a cocktail that will kill you and dial it back a notch so it doesn't. I think one day in the not too distant future, we'll look back at chemotherapy and go, whoa, that was a barbaric way to treat people. Because it basically poisons all the fastest growing cells in the body. That's why people lose their hair. That's why if I was to poke my tongue out at you at that time, you'd think you were looking at Swiss cheese or the surface of the moon. That's why a whole heap of other things didn't work properly, and I won't talk about them now. I started chemotherapy being told that we can only do this for four cycles. And then it's either send you off with goodwill and all the best, Or we might start this new thing which was coming in called maintenance therapy, where we reduce the dose, put you on some of the less toxic drugs, and we just continue that for a while. Well, after the first four cycles, my tumours had grown bigger. But I'm very grateful that someone said, no, let's try some maintenance. 3 months later, I had a scan. The tumours had started to shrink. The next 3 months, shrunk again. The next 3 months, shrunk again. In fact, maintenance, in my case, wasn't maintaining. It was actually, it was attacking and it was doing damage to the cancer. Move forward, 19 months, CT scan. I got the results. I didn't quite understand them. My wife understood them. She gave it to me and said, read this. Medical jargon, medical jargon, medical jargon, medical jargon, all the way down to the bottom. When it said no evidence of, and I didn't even know what the word was. And I said, what's this word? I can't remember it. And Fiona said, go and look it up. I said, just tell me what it means. No. I had to go to Wikipedia and work out what it meant. And it basically was a synonym for tumour or cancer. And after 19 to 20 months, I was getting a diagnosis coming back from the CT scans that said I had no evidence of disease. Now, that's absolutely stunning. That's unprecedented. I'm a little bit of a freak in our country, certainly through chemo. But they said, that doesn't mean you don't have cancer. That just means we can't see it. So we need to be even more vigilant in treating you. And so for 4 years, non-stop, I had chemotherapy. Every 3 weeks. The physical impact of that was extraordinary. I could plan ahead. You could say, do you want to come to my birthday party on the 27th of July? Did I get anyone? No, I didn't get anyone. And I'd look up the diary and I'd go, oh, no, sorry, I can't come. I'm going to be sick that week. And that could be months away because I'd have a three-weekly cycle where 1 week I'd be sick, bedridden, feeling like I had a heavy dose of the flu, and then I'd recover enough for 2 weeks to do it again. And I did that for over 4 years. Now, physical impact, massive. I'm still no evidence of disease. And I decided to have a holiday from chemo 2 years ago and I've not gone back. But the anxiety gets worse rather than better. I said I'd talk about 4Fs, so that's the first one, physical. Second one, family. Massive impact on family. It changed our whole plans. Each of my kids coped with it in different ways. I've heard from my now 19-year-old who's at Sydney University that he went out into the middle of the road one time when he was so distraught and he was screaming at the top of his lungs, I hate you, God. He was terrified that he'd lose his dad. I heard him sobbing in the... He's a tough kid. He played first grade rugby for 5 years through high school. But one morning I heard him just sobbing in the shower. And I hung around and I asked him, what's the matter, mate? And he said, I'm just worried I'm going to lose you. And that was 1 year to the day from my diagnosis. And that's how he got to celebrate. My daughter was amazing. But I got to write this book a couple of years later, and when she read the book, she just fell apart because she kept it all together. And my 21-year-old, who was up here at university, he started seeing a psychiatrist and a doctor on a regular basis because his anxiety was debilitating. Now, massive impact on family. Feelings, I was all over the shop. I think, you know how you have a stressful day at work or you've got an exam coming up and you get headaches or you get tight in the shoulders? You magnify that 100 times and imagine what's going on when you're dealing with terminal cancer. I was an emotional mess. I remember lying in a corner of my bedroom in the fetal position, just sobbing uncontrollably. I got so moody and so depressed and so anxious. I'd be up and down. My wife came in and spoke to me one time and she said, I don't want our kids to have two dads. Now, I misheard what she was saying because I thought, I don't want you to die and for me to have to marry another one. But what she was saying was, and it was based on her experience, her father became, he was a very physical bloke and he became blind for 2 years until they were able to operate and fix up his blindness. He became an incredibly angry, irritable person to be around, and she could see that starting to happen to me. And I don't want my kids, whose last memories of their dad, to be this irritable bloke. Now, the big thing, though, for me was the impact on my faith. And see, I'd been a Christian pastor for 20-something years, and I'd tried to encourage people to become Christians. I had been speaking to people about my confidence in resurrection, based on the resurrection of Jesus so many years ago. And now I'm being told that I probably have 10 months to live. It's interesting, isn't it? You can believe something and you can be confident about it, but it's kind of theory. And then something happens that turns that theory into an existential nightmare. And for me, I had to ask questions about whether there was a God, whether that God cared, whether there was a Saviour, Jesus, whether he was a real person, whether he lived, whether he died, and whether his death on a cross actually had significance for me now, whether he rose again on Easter Sunday, and therefore whether there was hope beyond the grave. See, I was being told that I had no medical, no physical, no personal hope. So all I had to go on was hope of being raised from the dead. Now, that sounds pretty weird, doesn't it? But that was something that I needed now to work out, because when you're lying potentially on your deathbed, there's not much value in wishful thinking. And so I got really pushed back to the drawing board. I had to explore questions that I'd asked when I was at university 30-something years before. Is Jesus a real person? Is there historical evidence for this man? Did he do and say things that need explanation? Does the evidence point to him being the Son of God? Was he actually killed by crucifixion? Does the New Testament have any corroboration with other documents? Is there accounts of Jesus in other parts of history? And what about his resurrection? I mean, is this wishful thinking that's influenced a great myth that Christians believe? Well, the Christians, that is the followers of Jesus, who first started talking about Jesus' resurrection, many of them went to their graves because they were so convinced that that would be true. Some of them could have had an opt-out. No, we've made that up. See, it's one thing to be deluded, it's another thing to create a lie. And it's much harder to believe that the New Testament, that the original followers of Jesus created a lie, than that they actually changed their lives based on what they'd seen. Now, I understand a guy who spoke here as a lecturer in ancient history at Macquarie University recently, and I don't claim to be an expert in history, but I went back and I started asking those historical questions. Is there a Jesus? Can he offer me hope beyond cancer, beyond death? And in the process of that, I was being pushed to ask those questions because I was diagnosed with a terminal illness. Now, that's quite funny in a way, because I didn't suddenly get a terminal illness. I'd had it from the very beginning. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, I'd had cancer for a long time. I don't know how long the cancer had been there. Best estimates are 5 years. It had been growing inside me. But what I'm saying is that from the moment I was born, I was going to die. All right? My friend's grandmother lived to 107. She was the oldest woman in Canberra up until a year ago when she died. That's a long time. Most of us probably won't live to 100. Some of us won't live that long at all. But we have this terminal illness. It's called life. And I've been mixing now for quite a long time with other people who have cancer or have had cancer. And I fully get their incredible hope that there will one day be found a cure to cancer. And I'm 100% pro-cure. I'm absolutely delighted that since I was diagnosed, they've invented three generations of targeted drugs that I can go back to if my cancer rears its head. I'm absolutely committed to advocating for that, raising funds for that, supporting that, but it's only a limited solution. And I came to realise that even if I didn't die from cancer, and I pray that I won't, that I'll still die. And so will you. It's not something that we think about terribly often, but my experience and the journey that I went on caused me to ask some of those serious questions that we ignore. I was going to Peter MacCallum Cancer Institute in Melbourne for some treatment, and I sat down at a coffee shop and I was talking with the owner, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I explained what I was doing. We got into a conversation for about 15 or 20 minutes. And after we'd finished, he thanked me for the conversation. And he said, "Isn't it a shame that we," and I think these were his words, "that we fart ass around with trivia all of our lives, and it's not until something like this happens that we start to ask the big questions." And I want to encourage you to ask those questions, to find those answers. This group here exists because they believe that the death and the resurrection of Jesus is real, and that it can make a difference and should make a difference to you, not just for this life, but for all eternity. I've become convinced of that a second time around, and I want to commend that to you as well. Now, I don't have a watch, so I've no idea. I'm sure I've gone for way too long already, but we've got 5 minutes. If you'd like to ask any questions, I'm happy to answer anything on any topic. Doesn't mean I know the answer. I'll tell you if I don't. Yeah. While you're thinking about it, not that I'm spruiking these books, but let me spruik this book. This is something that I wrote after 2 years, and I started writing it in the midst of hard cancer treatment when I had visible tumours in my body. This is not a follow these three steps and you'll be cured book, because I didn't believe when I finished this that I was cured, and to be honest, I still don't know if I am. But it's my struggle with cancer and my struggle with faith to look for answers. And if you want to think through these more, have a look at it. If you've got someone in your life that's battling with cancer or something serious like that, it's written for them. And you might want to get one. Any questions? Yeah.
What are the hopes to cancer strugglers cling to?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
How do you talk to them, I suppose you just said?
Yeah, there's actually a chapter in that about the different things, because we find hope in good medicine. That's the first thing I want to go. Have you got a good doctor? Are they doing good testing? Have they got a good strategy and help people to navigate that? We find hope, and I've got an acronym for this, HOPE, H-O-P-E. So that's healthcare. We find help in others, carers, family, loved ones, friends, being there for you. So important. We find hope in purpose, P, having a reason to get up in the morning. See, when I was told that I would be dead in a bit over a year, most likely, and everything would be downhill, I went into serious depression. And then a friend took me aside one time and said, "No, look, I want to encourage you to be a blessing to people. And there's a number of ways that you could be." And that helped me to get out of the funk and stop, the self-pity somewhat, and to have reasons to care for others, to have reasons to invest in my kids while I had an opportunity. If you've got no purpose, then you go downhill very quickly. But E, eternity, that was the thing that radically transformed me. Wow, I was only ever going to have a short life. It's a short life in the light of eternity, whether I live 10 years or 100 years. So let's focus on what's going to matter for a long, 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 long time. Yeah. I've spent, yeah.
What's on
Yeah, look, I've bagged my specialist in the book for his response. I don't say who it is or anything, but now you know. He said, fairly forthright, you've got stage 4 lung cancer, you'll probably live 10 to 13 months. It would have been more helpful for a different response. And I did, very grateful to God that a friend introduced me to another oncologist who is always happy to take a phone call. And he said this, and this is what I'd recommend, that is, you've got a serious cancer, no doubt about it. It's a cancer that we've not had good results in dealing with, but we're going to do absolutely everything that we can for you. Now, isn't that just a more optimistic approach? And that's what this other guy was like. He said, oh, look, some cancers, they're now more like chronic disease than terminal disease. You know, some people, they'll live out their whole life with cancer, but they won't die from the cancer. I went, oh, okay, that's another way of looking at it. And that helped me to pick up emotionally.
If there's someone in your life who's experienced cancer, but you don't know how to start a conversation with them about maybe how they're feeling or how it's impacted them in the past, how can you open that conversation without being like...
Yeah. Like, people hear that question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I've got a fail-proof 6-word start. I don't know what to say. Don't be pedantic, because don't is really 2 words shrunk into one. I don't know what to say. Look, that's better than I know how you feel, or you must be this, or look, my aunt had cancer too, and I was there when she died, and it was awful, and you know, she was frothing at the mouth, and it was so painful, and you know, that they had to put her down. No, I'm being a little bit mischievous there, but conversations so often go that way. Instead of listening to people, we go, oh yeah, I had this. It's like tennis, isn't it? Yeah, it's my turn for a shot. Let me tell you about my cat who died of cancer, and you know, that actually happened to me, by the way. So I don't know what to say. Let me tell you one of the saddest things that I saw. I was at a cancer council, Relay for Life. They interviewed a guy who'd been admitted to hospital. He spent 9 weeks in hospital, and not one of his friends visited him in 9 weeks. Now, I couldn't believe that. I actually went to the back of the stage and I said, are you feeding him? Seriously, no one. He said, no, they were too scared to. And since they've said, oh, we wouldn't know what to say, or we'd be worried about saying the wrong thing. Well, let me say, they said the wrong thing. The wrong thing was nothing. They did the wrong thing. They didn't turn up. So be there. I've heard some great foot and mouth things from people, but I know that they care. I don't judge people for saying, look, I know what you're feeling, or, you know, I know God's going to heal you, or even, you know, if you had more faith, you would be healed, etc. All these sorts of helpful things that people say. But being there, being present. And as I said, I don't know what to say. It's a good start. And then listen. Tell me, what's it like for you? Help me to understand it more. I've known some people have had cancer, but I don't really get it. Like, tell me what it is for you. Because what it is for them too will be different to what it was for someone else. And I've got to remember it's different for me. And I'm very experienced with cancer, but I'm not very experienced with anybody else's cancer. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if there's anything at all that you say, or if you just pray.
Look, I'll tell you one of the things my wife says, because I think she's a GP, so she works with a lot of people, and she'd know more people who've got terminal things than the average person. She often asks people whether they have any spiritual beliefs or whether they've got any spiritual background. And that's not as blunt as talking straight up about Christian things, but most people have something somewhere that they will then... And so listening and talking and exploring those things. With this book, though, for example, I've given hundreds and hundreds of copies of that away, and I know that other people have. And one of the things that I will say to people is it explores my doubts. So it's not me coming across saying, look, I've got the answers. And this is what I found. This is how I worked on things. This is what I learnt. You know, let me encourage you to do that too. And what have you got to lose? Being gentle. It's time. I'm happy to hang around and talk if people would like to talk further. Thanks.
Thank him again in a second.
I just felt like he needed a standing ovation.
We'll give him one in a minute, though.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Karen,
you're gonna start. She can come back.
I'll be 2 minutes. What a testimony. Praise God. Thank you so much. A lot of hope in there. My name is Clara Albert. I'm just going to pray. Before that, Paul's asked me to just tell the staff that's around of our CAPS groups. There are 3 CAPS groups on the campus for staff, and if you're new or you would like to be in a group, contact Paul and he'll try his best to work around your logistics, timing wise, which buildings, etc. I work in the accounting discipline in Building 8. We have a group there as well. So any students around, Credo groups, where you can get personal support as well, and then.